Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the PFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Nina Kraus about her new book, Of Sound Mind, How Our Brain Constructs a Meaningful Sonic World. How sound leaves a fundamental imprint on who we are. Making sense of sound is one of the hardest jobs we ask our brains to do. In Of Sound Mind, Nina Kraus examines the partnership of sound and brain, showing for the first time that processing of sound drives many of the brain's core functions. Kraus shows how our engagement with sound leaves a fundamental imprint of who we are. The sounds of our lives shape our brains, for better and for worse, and help us build the sonic world we live in. Well, Nina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here with us today. So as we have just witnessed the recent times of the global pandemic, I was wondering if you could start by reflecting on how has it affected you and your work, and maybe some main takeaways that you have gathered from this experience.
Sure. You know, from the beginning, I have been so grateful. I've been so grateful that I and my husband and have been able to continue working and continue doing, you know, what we love to do. So I think that, you know, we've been extraordinarily fortunate, given that there are many people who did not have that opportunity. With respect to the work in my lab, which we call Brain Vaults, you know, we have an ongoing study with football players, and actually all of our Division I athletes, males and females, for many sports, and they continued to play during much of the pandemic. And so we continued that arm of the work on site, and the rest of the work, we, of course, just did it remotely, both the teaching and all of our data analysis and lab meetings and such. The pandemic also, you know, I think it made me realize more than ever how important sound is, and how, you know, the fact that it became so much quieter, our world became quieter, just brought home the fact that, you know, we ordinarily live in such a noisy world, and we don't honor the beauty of our soundscape as much as we could. So that was also something that came through to me.
That's an excellent point. Do you think other people also started appreciating soundscape, for example, in their gardens after this experience?
They did. And you know, people just kept remarking how, you know, how they could hear the birds in a way that they couldn't hear before. And what was really interesting is that scientists looked at, they made many field recordings of birds and found that actually the birds were singing more quietly than they had before. And, you know, because they didn't have to be screeching over the noise. And the other thing that they were able to do is they sang more intricate songs. And that's very important from a mating perspective for the birds, because, you know, it's the male bird who sings and the female who chooses. And the female is much more likely to choose a male who can sing a strong and elaborate song. So the fact that now the birds were able to sing a more elaborate song, and interestingly, even though they were singing more quietly, their bird songs carried a longer distance than before the pandemic.
Oh, that's fascinating. So you already mentioned that you run a lab. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and what you do?
Yeah. So, yeah, I have a wonderful lab, which is my scientific family, and I really approach everything from a personal standpoint. And I think that one of the things that I try to get across in my book of Sound Mind is how science is a deeply personal endeavor. You know, it is performed by humans. And so I try to get that across. And in my lab, we have individuals who work at Brain Vaults. We call ourselves Brain Vaults, who come from many different they bring different experience, engineering and music, clinical, really the kind of background that a person has to work in our lab is really broad. And broad also, I think it fits in very well with the kinds of studies that we do. So if you go to the homepage of our website, which I encourage everyone to do, it's a labor of love, and there's a little icon of a bus. Take the tour of the website so you can find what you're looking for. But on the homepage, you will see that there are pictures of all the different topics that we study. And we study music, we study rhythm, reading, bilingualism, concussion, aging, language disorders like autism. I'm sure I'm forgetting the hearing in noise. So there are many, many topics. And you know, you might ask yourself, what are they doing at Brain Vaults? And all of this is under the umbrella of sound and the brain, which really, I think, brings home the fact that sound is pervasive, and it's pervasively a part of everything that we do, almost everything that we do, and so many things that we hold dear.
And how did you get interested in studying brain?
Well, I grew up in a house where more than one language was spoken. My first language is Italian, and My mother was a musician, and I loved to I always play underneath the piano because it felt the sound was just wonderful there while she played. And then when I went to college, I majored in comparative literature because I liked to read and I knew some languages. But then I took it was such a good reason to have to take distribution requirements at that time. I took biology and I thought, oh, this is for me. I love biology. This is fun. And then I discovered a book called The Biological Foundations of Language. And I thought, holy cow, I can marry these two interests of mine, you know, how language works biologically. And so I decided to get a degree in neuroscience. And I have studied sound and the brain from then until now.
I really like how you referred to your lab as a family. So I was wondering, what, in your opinion, is the significance really for young students to have a good mentor? And what would you tell them?
Yes, I think it's important to have not only a good mentor, but a good team. Because when the Brain Vaults is really is a team, and it is very much like the brain, in that, you know, there is so much interaction among the different members, and we all participate in every study, and so everyone has their own point of view. And when a student comes into the lab, they interact not just with me, but with the other experts in the lab who bring their own view to the work that is done. Now, not every lab is run like my lab. You know, that people have different philosophies, and when they teach, they teach differently. But for me, I have decided, and it's really something that has evolved over the years, to have this community of people. And, you know, everyone, and, you know, working at Brain Vault is not for everyone. So, you know, we really people generally stay for a long time, and they if it's a good match, they are generous of spirit because we all pitch in for each other. We take care of each other, and we like to eat. We bring good food, and we have meals together. This is something that I really missed over the social isolation period, because we would always meet every day for lunch and bring our food, and we'd often have parties with we have some really wonderful chefs in the mix. So eating is something that everybody has to do, just like listening to sound and making sound and having sound be a part of our lives. It's very important to me, again, to do something that is of interest to a broad swath of people. Obviously I'm interested in communicating to all the scientists within, our ivory tower of science, but I'm really especially interested in communicating and learning from the people who use sound in their lives. And that was really my motivation for writing this book, is that I really, this is a book that is written for you. It is written for anyone who may not have a science background at all, but is interested in the powerful forces in our lives. And of course, sound is a very powerful force in our life. And so it's written with the things that I have learned, but really told to the way I have found myself over the years. People are interested in what we do at BrainVolts, and so they are always asking questions and wanting to know more. And I thought, well, gee, why don't I put this together in one place? So I did that, but I really did it. It has a tone, I hope, that is a dinner time conversation tone that you need to think about and engage with thoughtfully.
So your book is Of Sound Mind, How Our Brains Construct a Meaningful Sonic World. And I'm really glad that you mentioned your motivations for writing it, really bringing it to other people. So I have so many questions. So let's delve into some of the science that you cover in your book. So first of all, what is sound?
Well, so the first part of the book, the first quarter of the book or so, is it is how sound works, it's called. And I feel like a child every time this topic comes up. How kids want to hear the same story again and again. Well, I always want to hear the story about sound, whether I'm telling it or someone else is telling it. It is just so fascinating to think about. And each time I think about it, I enjoy it and get something, a deeper appreciation. It is really the idea that sound is movement. Sound is the movement of air, and there are ingredients in sound. And another thing about sound is that sound is invisible. And we live in a very, increasingly visually biased world. But sound, an invisible force like gravity, is pretty important. In the same way as a visual object has different ingredients like size and texture and color, sound, first of all, it's there in the first place, and it also is full of ingredients like pitch, timing, timbre, harmonics, loudness, phase. There are so many ingredients of sound in the sound waves, and the brain needs to make sense of all of these ingredients. And this is a marvel, because the brain needs to take all of these ingredients, and one of the metaphors that I use in the book is of the brain as a mixing board. So you can envision all of the ingredients in a mixing bowl coming into the ear and into the brain, and then you have this brain that has the different faders on a mixing board that go up and down, and they go up and down depending on your life in sound, what you have, the particular sound to meaning connections you have made over your lifetime. And so you will have particular strengths and particular bottlenecks, and we can tell a lot about an individual and also groups of individuals by looking at these patterns on the mixing board. And the way that we can do that is, of course, as I'm speaking now, the neurons in your brain are producing electricity, and this electricity can be captured just with electrodes put on the scalp, and we can measure that information, that electricity. So we're going from a sound wave to a brain wave. You know, the currency of the nervous system is electricity, and we have that electrical response then that we can look at, and I can look at your response to sound, and I can see, oh, you have these strengths and these bottlenecks, and I can probably tell that you have had musical experience, or that you speak a couple of languages. It's really pretty wonderful, we can answer these. Or at least begin to answer these very difficult questions, like, you know, what makes us us, and how do we remember, why does music make us feel the way it does? Why do we respond so strongly when we hear someone who is speaking our native language? I feel like I have some grounding on what. On these important questions, because we look at the biology with signals. So it's really signals outside the head being translated into signals inside the head. And these are really quite tangible, and they keep me grounded, and they allow me to look at these very rich questions in a way that is really quite objective and biologically based.
So then each of us has individual fingerprint, do we, for sound perception and the way we process the sounds?
That's absolutely right. And we can see that in the sound wave. So we can take, you know, three typical listeners and have them listen to the same sound. And you will find that you can certainly recognize what the sound was by the brain's response in all the three listeners, but each response is going to be different. And we have a signature, and if I record your brain response today, and then I record your brain response tomorrow, just like when you write your signature, it's going to pretty much be the same signature. It's something, our sonic minds, our life and sound makes us us. It really contributes to who we are, which to me is profound, and is something that is not readily appreciated, which again is one of the reasons that I wrote my book of Sound Mind, How Our Brain Constructs a Meaningful Sonic World.
That is so interesting to me, because I work within the neurodegenerative field, and we know that in some patients with dementia, they remember music that, for example, their mother played, or some lullabies some music from their youth. So why is it that we remember some of those sounds?
Yes. Well, there is the expression, it's so good to hear the sound of your voice. Well, why is that? You know, when I speak to my, I have three children, when I speak to them over the phone, you know, we first just revel in how wonderful it is to hear each other's voices. It's so good to hear the sound of your voice because, you know, we have spent years back and forth making sound to meaning, sound to feeling connections with that particular sound. And something that you should know about the sound mind is that it engages how we think, so what we know, how we feel, how we move, and how the sound interacts with information that we get from other senses. So the sound mind, the sound brain, the hearing brain is vast, and it is deeply, deeply tied. Sound is deeply tied to our memories. So, you know, think about the fact that you know, we didn't use writing until about 5,000 years ago, but humans have been speaking and using sound for hundreds of thousands of years. So this is very deeply embedded, and it's deeply embedded in many, many, many organisms. Sound is what signals, you know, is this a sound that is going to hurt me? Can I have it for lunch? Can I mate with it? You know, these are really important signals for survival that you know, all animals have. Sound is a very evolutionarily ancient sense, and so you can see, or you can begin to imagine how sound and memories, because you have to remember that sound that almost ate you. You have to remember the next time you hear that, you are going to get away faster. So to make a connection with sound and memory, which again, you had to do even more strongly before we could write things down. You know, history was sung and it was carried down through the bards. And, you know, people had to remember what the stories were. And there were orators who had to tell stories and narratives, and you know, they needed to remember all of this. So sound and memory are very, very, very tightly linked, to the extent that when we forget almost everything else and we don't, you know, hardly recognize the world that we live in, if we have dementia, people still can recognize and be brought back to life by the sounds that were important to them, that they had sound to meaning connections with. Again, the sound, it's sound to meaning. It engages the things that they know, the things that that have meaning for them, that they have feelings about. Because again, the hearing brain engages our hearing, all of our senses, our feeling, how we move, and what we know.
Does this also work for mnemonics? When you try to remember something, you could put it to the tune.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, historically, it was really the bards and the chorus eventually that helped bring carry the history forward from generation to generation. And you know, we learned our you know, our ABC with a song. You know, we can learn things very well when you put words together with a melody and a rhythm. The rhythm is also tremendously important, and so that also helps with the memory. Yes, it solidifies the memory.
So as we live in such a huge sonic world, how does our brain differentiate between the sounds that are important and which are not?
Yeah. So this is something that we learn over time, which is why, and again, this is another of the motivations for my writing this book of Sound Mind. It's my call to action, because what we do in our lives, you know, biologically, we are what we do. So it's very important for us to be making good choices about how we spend our time and how our children spend their time and how, as a society, we spend our time. And, you know, I think none of us individually can change the world in terms of the sonic landscape, but we can make decisions in our lives and in our communities to help us honor and be able to engage in making sense of sound in a meaningful way so that it strengthens our sonic mind. And it at the same time, we want to be able to minimize the amount of noise, for example, the unwanted sounds that even if you learn to ignore them, you know, so, you know, everybody has had the experience of not knowing a sound was there until it was gone. And, you know, so for example, you could be the refrigerator might turn off, or the truck outside will turn its ignition off, or the air conditioning will cycle off. And often people's response to that is, because the sound was there, even though you didn't know it was there until it turned off, and it was affecting our biology because of what I said before, because we have such a tight coupling of sound with our survival. When we hear, you know, sounds, I think you know, we're in a constant state of alarm, and we don't even know it. And I truly believe that part of the reason as a society we seem to be becoming increasingly nervous and stressed and anxious, I think in part it has to do with the fact that there is so much unwanted, unnecessary, often sound that, again, people don't think about it. You know, they don't give it a thought. You know, they'll put in an air conditioner, and you know, we have choices, and people don't really think about, oh, well, this air conditioner is going to be quieter. They really are just focused on, I want to get cooler. So if that becomes more front of mind, then people will begin to make these kinds of better decisions. And even if, you know, and again, I think eventually it will be more expensive. It will be the more expensive option to get a quieter air conditioner. But, you know, there's no reason why we can't have much quieter hair dryers, for example. And again, it's really a matter of people recognizing the importance of sound, the importance of sound to our health, because if there is a lot of noise, we really do know that it affects our ability to concentrate, to think, to sleep, and very importantly, to hear each other. And I think that this comes to probably the most important piece of the message of my book, in Of Sound Mind. The message is that sound connects us. And it connects us in the present, in the moment. It connects us the way no other sense does. You know, right now, you and I are having this conversation back and forth. There is this reciprocity, and we don't have a script. You know, we're responding to each other. And that's beautiful. That's very alive. It's very immediate. It's what Ian McGilchrist calls betweenness, and it's precious. And it connects us. It is something that, and again, one of the things that characterizes sound is that, you know, it's here. It's in the moment. It's completely alive, and then it's gone. It's not like an object that you can hold. So it's just completely. It is truly alive, and it connects us in a profound and important way that I feel we should, you know, people ask, you know, how do I strengthen my sound mind? And you know, a very basic thing that we can all do better is to talk to each other and, you know, to talk to our kids instead of our phones, to use sound as this way of reciprocating and feeling that we have something in common. And of course, that's something that music does in a tremendously efficient and beautiful way.
Yes, this really changes my perception and perspective on sound. And I was wondering about silence. So how natural, if you can put it this way, is silence to us?
Yes, well, you know, we need silence even for sound to occur. So think about, you know, as we're talking now, there isn't sound every constantly. There are pauses. There is the space between words. It helps us understand turn taking. It helps us understand where one word begins and ends. In music, we have the note values, but we also have the rest values. So the space between the notes makes the notes worthwhile. So, you know, the silence is very important. And silence also has a deeply, just silence in general, has a deeply spiritual side to it. It is not an accident that almost every religion and also when we are honoring an event or someone, you know, we say, can we have a moment of silence? And again, that moment of silence enables us to reflect and often the noise in our lives robs us of that ability to reflect. And that seems like an important thing to be able to hold on to as a human.
Oh yes, absolutely. That's why I love my noise cancelling headphones. So I was wondering about language, because language is such a unique human trait that we're able to use it. So how language sounds like words are processed in our brain compared to other sounds?
Yes, I love that question. It's a beautiful, beautiful question. And our sound minds are sculpted. They are shaped by the language we speak. What is your first language?
Russian.
Russian. Ah. I wish I would be better at recognizing different speakers, but it has a beautiful sound that right away I respond to very, very positively. It's, you know, it's a part of what makes you you. And we know that babies will right away shape their brains. We can measure this in response to the sounds of the languages and also of the music that has meaning for them. And this happens throughout our lives. It's interesting also that if you speak another language, your brain becomes especially good at processing the fundamental frequency of a sound, which is the sound, it's an ingredient that gives us a lot of information about pitch and about voice pitch. So, you know, your voice has a certain pitch to it. My voice has a certain pitch to it. And if we're listening, you know, and we're in a group of people, I can pull out the sound of your voice because, you know, in the biz, we would call it an auditory object. You know, the sound of Karen is the sound of an object in that we can recognize, just as the sound of Bill and the sound of running water. You know, we have and this fundamental frequency is something that really enables us to group our sounds into distinct, I hate to use the word objects, but that's just what the field uses. But people who speak another language or multiple languages are especially good, and you can just measure this in their brain's response to a speech sound. It doesn't even matter what language is being spoken. That fundamental frequency processing is really robust, and that is something that helps a speaker of multiple languages make sense of especially a complex soundscape.
So that's talking when we can perceive sound well. And what happens in some cases when we cannot?
Yes. So, there are various reasons why we cannot perceive sound well. One is what we've been talking about in terms of noise outside the head. But there is also noise inside the head. You know, we find that some children who have been raised with linguistic deprivation and often raised in poverty, we see excessive neural noise. So, the electricity in our brain is always on, and the neurons are firing in a disorganized way. And linguistic deprivation increases the amount of neural noise in the brain. And I think that that's just because, a child can't help but try to make sense of sound. And if they're not getting stimulated with strong enough sound to meaning connections, they will make up other electrical activity, which can also get in the way of developing language and, being a strong language user. Some work that we have done with elite athletes has shown that very physically fit individuals have excessively quiet brains. So that enables the athlete to really make sense of all of the stimulation that is going on around them. You're probably thinking also about hearing loss. And if someone has a hearing loss, that is going to affect, of course, the input into the brain. What is important to recognize is that, if someone has a hearing loss, the impact of that hearing loss is going to be greater than what most people think, because hearing involves how we think and feel and move and incorporate our information from other senses. If you're not hearing well, you're not able to think about what is being said. And it actually can dull your thinking skills. So, people don't often realize that, if they need a hearing aid, it's not just so that they can hear the sounds better, but it's also so that they can make use of them and think about them. That said, if you have a strong sound mind, there are things that really can help you, even if you have a hearing loss. So, for example, some of the work we've done, we've been able to look at older adults who have the identical hearing loss that you would get in the higher sound frequencies. This is a typical age-related hearing loss. And if you take a musician and a non-musician with the same exact hearing, so hearing loss, the musician is able to make much better sense of sound. They can understand sound better in noisy places. They have better processing speed. They are able to make sense of the sounds and remember the sounds better than someone with the same hearing loss. So, and by the way, when I talk about a musician, I'm not just talking about a professional musician. I'm talking about, you know, people like you or me who might just regularly play a musical instrument. It really does change how one is able to make sense of sound, as also, I mean, other work that has been done on bilingualism has shown that as we age, speaking another language can have protective effects with respect to our thinking skills.
This is really fascinating, and I think the title of your book makes so much more sense now. It has this duality, doesn't it?
So tell me how you are thinking about it, and I will respond.
On one side, it's all about the actual sound, so the movement of, for example, air or some other liquid where the sound travels, and then this part of our perception of it, so thinking, and it's really interesting. I keep going between the two.
Yes, and that's, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because that's exactly my intention, because sound is alive itself. You know, it is the movement. You cannot have sound without movement. It's movement, and as we, our brain makes sense of it, there is this engagement of, you know, what we formally call our cognitive, sensory, motor, and reward systems. That's all part of our hearing, but there is this reciprocity. And let me tell you, so one of the languages that I learned to speak is harmony, singing harmony. So if you've ever, have you ever sung harmony with somebody?
Not really, no. But I've heard somebody do it, yeah.
Yes. Well, if somebody is I love to sing harmony, you know, when people are just getting together singing songs. And this is something I learned from my mother, my Italian mamma. And she would sing with my dad. And so it's something that I just learned to do. I don't know how I do it, but I can do it. And to me, it is this beautiful example of this back and forth, the reciprocity. When you are singing harmony with somebody, you are listening to what they are singing, and then you are adjusting your own voice and movements accordingly. And then the person who is singing harmony with you is listening to you and adjusting their movements and their voice, their sound. And this continues. It just goes, you know, as we listen and move, this goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth as we tune to each other. You know, how beautiful is that?
It's like a conversation in sound.
Indeed.
So now, thinking about the bigger picture, I was wondering how our relationship with our sounds were shaped and are shaped by our social and maybe economic forces.
Yes. I think that is certainly the case. Speaking as a biologist, we are shaped by what we do, and you know what we do is very much affected by the world that we live in. And so thinking about social and economic forces, if you just take the example of beeping trucks, so you know there are reasons that having a truck make a sound as it backs up, especially in a construction zone. This can be an important warning signal. On the other hand, it seems like every delivery van has these beeps that are very loud, and but yet we just accept them And, you know, we also think we're tuning them out. You know, what else are we tuning out? Again, we live in a society where it's easy to measure how many people were injured by a truck that backed up. And, you know, we live in this very, trying to quantify things society. And yet, it's very hard to measure the effects that, the constant beeping may have on our sound minds, on our ability to think, on our ability to interact with each other. Again, if we are ignoring so many sounds in our soundscape, what else are we ignoring? So these are things that I think this is something that I really try to get across in my book, is that there are often not hard and fast yes, no, definitive answers to things. Everything has to be taken in context. And in fact, my students are always protesting because they want to know the answer. And almost always I tell them, it depends. So, you know, I think that it's important to be thinking about any issue in our sound world and in our sonic landscape, and to be really thinking about, is it necessary if it's noise, and really making changes accordingly. And, you know, we can make changes in our lives. For example, I deeply believe that it is very, very good for people's ability to think and engage with the world if they have a musical education. You know, I think that every child should have a musical education. I also think that music has a real place in medicine. Both for Alzheimer's, we use music all the time in the gym to help us with movement. So music, it can be used in Parkinson's disease, for example, to strengthen movement. But in anybody in just moving their bodies, and yes, there is such a thing as music education. There is such a thing as music in medicine, but it is not as pervasive as I believe it should be. It should be something that is just a given, that is just part of our society, in the same way as we teach our children how to write. We should teach them about music, and medicine should also should consider sound. And in fact, one of the things that we're especially interested in is in our work with athletes. The idea, we're looking at athletes, healthy athletes, and then also athletes who have sustained a concussion. So why is that? Well, making sense of sound is one of the hardest jobs that we ask our brains to do, and it means really being able to process information in microseconds, and this precision is disrupted if you get a blow to the head. People historically have looked at vision and at balance, but not at hearing. And it is, remarkable how much correspondence I get from people who learn about our work at BrainVolts and other work like it, or have read my book, and they say, this is me. You're describing me. Ever since I've had a concussion, I have difficulty hearing speech in a noisy place, or I'm very hypersensitive to sound. So the athletes know, but it's not in the mainstream of concussion practice, which I hope someday it will be. But I'm also hoping that in terms of therapies, there may be ways of engaging rhythm as a way of healing the concussed brain. Because, you know, our brain produces rhythms, and to help the brain become resynchronized after a concussion is something that I think has potential.
So what discoveries along your journey to writing of Sound Mind surprised you the most?
I get surprised all the time. I was certainly surprised by when we began studying rhythm. I thought that if you were good at one kind of rhythm skill, you would be good at other rhythm skills because you would just be good at rhythm. But no, I was wrong. If you just take, a passage like a shave and a haircut to bits, you're tapping along with it, and you're tapping along to the beat, and this is what you tap your foot to or snap your fingers to, da 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 da, which is very different from if you tap along to the pattern, which is right. And if you think about this in musical terms, the beat is shown by the time signature, you know, so this could be in 4/4 time, right? And it's steady and regular. And the pattern, of course, is the values of the notes and the rests. And I thought if you were good at producing one kind of rhythm activity, you'd be good at the other. And it turns out that it's not true at all. And, you know, converging evidence from other groups have really shown how these are very different rhythmic skills, and that you cannot predict how well somebody is going to do with one rhythm activity from how they do on the other. So, I think mostly I am always reminded by how complicated something is. Way more complicated than I thought in the first place. So that's an example. I also am increasingly interested in how sound is an important way of communicating, and also an important factor not only in human and in animal life, but also in plant and tree life. Any plumber can tell you that tree roots are going to go into the pipes underground, and that's because the trees have a way of actually sensing the sound at the frequency, the fundamental frequency of running water. Not everybody knows. I didn't know that if you take that there is a blossom on a plant, that it will not release its pollen unless it is visited by a bee that buzzes at a particular frequency. So this flower is tuned, very specially tuned to sound. And so the pervasiveness of sound as a physical force and as a way of connecting within and across species is something that increasingly is an area that I think we can know much more about.
Oh boy, now I feel bad for my cactus, depriving it from the sound of the running water.
Well, this is what I mean in terms of we have control over the choices we make. So maybe you can have your cactus hear the sound of running water, and maybe it'll send its little roots in the direction of the sink.
Exactly. I'll put it close to when I make my coffee so it can hear a little bit. So what is your favorite instrument and why is it a theremin?
Well, I don't have a favorite instrument, you know, like people, and I don't have a favorite food. People ask me, what kind of food do you like? And I say, good food. You know, what kind of music do you like? Good music. I play a couple of instruments, not especially well, but with great joy. I play some piano, electric guitar, some drums, harmonica. I like to sing harmony. So, you know, that's always fun. And it's always really nice to listen to the instruments that you have some experience with. I'm fortunate to, my husband is a musician, and so he's really good. And I can hear, you know, the sounds of his playing. And when he plays with his colleagues, and that's just wonderful to me. Again, it's personal, and I get to know it over time. So I really can't say that I have a favorite sound or a favorite instrument. It you know, it'll depend on who's playing it and how it's played and what they're playing.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
Well, I alluded a little bit to one of the things that is really of interest to us. So on the one hand, we're continuing to investigate rhythm and music, and making this connection between our music work and our concussion and head injury work. And I really do believe that a strong path is the ability to understand how rhythm therapies, and it may be, you know, in the form of a digital music therapy. You know, it could be a digital program like Interactive Metronome, you know, that requires an interaction with the person, the athlete, with hearing sounds and responding and physically, and then, you know, we are trying to understand the brain activity and how you know, there is some early evidence indicating that this kind of rhythm therapy may possibly be a viable treatment to alleviate concussion symptoms. And that to me is something that I would really dearly love to pursue in a rigorous, highly powered, which means a lot of people across many different sports, males and females, and to really do a strong study to investigate this, because it has the potential to, most importantly, it has the potential to strengthen the options that people have in concussion treatment and management. And I think that it will teach us a lot about the brain and how the brain is injured and how it can recover following injury.
That sounds super interesting. So where can our listeners find more information about your work and also your book?
You asked a question that's close to my heart. Please, listeners, do go to our website. So that's www.brainvolts.northwestern.edu. And again, it is a labor of love, and do take that little tour and find what you're looking for. So that's one. And as far, you know, the book really is what I hope everyone will be reading over the holidays. And that, of course, can be purchased at your favorite bookstore, wherever you get books.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today and for this truly illuminating discussion.
Thank you so much for having me.